Hello and welcome to Trolling with Logic for 20th October 2012. We're a bi-weekly podcast on issues of religion, science, scepticism and philosophy from a secular perspective. My wonderful co-hosts tonight are Kitch.
Hey guys.
Sound of silence after a long sabbatical. From.
Hello, nice to be back, and hello from my room in college.
Oh, right. Martimer.
Hi.
And Big Lundy.
Greetings, everybody.
All right, to call in, as always, you add Skype contact Trolling with Logic, and please remember, all calls, the whole show is uploaded to iTunes and YouTube for later viewing. So if you do call in, you're kind of allowing us to use your likeness. Also, if you do want to call in, you can just ask questions via the chat room. Also, given the nature of the show tonight, it's towards the end we'll be taking questions. So if you can hold off for the last 45 minutes, we'll start fielding questions. And so without further ado, I'll hand over to our ever-reliable moderator, Big Lundy, to introduce our guest.
Greetings to all of our viewers, and thank you for joining us today on Saturday, October the 20th. Today we're going to be devoting a substantial amount of time with our guest to go over a recent book he's written, Answers for Aristotle. Other books he's written include Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk, and Denying Evolution, Creationism, Scientism, and the Nature of Science. Ladies and gentlemen, biologist and philosopher, chair of the philosophy department of the City University of New York, Lehman College, Dr. Massimo Pigliucci.
Hello.
Wonderful to have you on the show, Dr. Pigliucci.
It's a pleasure.
So, for those that don't know, Dr. Pigliucci sent me his book that is now available in fine bookstores everywhere, as well as Amazon, Answers for Aristotle, and I've read through it, and I have questions, but to be honest, I would personally just recommend reading the book anyway, because it's just a fantastic read. It's not very technical, it's put into pretty simple terms so that you can understand it. So even if you're not educated on philosophy or science, you can still follow along with pretty much everything that's written. So I have a vast number of questions, so we'll get started. First question is, in your first chapter, you go over what you consider to be the differences between science, philosophy, and what philosophy is. Would you mind expounding as to your position on these things?
Right. So, as you know, science used to be part of philosophy. It was called natural philosophy, and this was true up until the beginning of the scientific revolution in the 1600s and early 1700s. The first scientists that we recognize in the modern sense of the term were people like Galileo or Newton, and they actually thought of themselves as philosophers. But of course, especially during the 19th century and mostly through the 20th century, both philosophy and science have become specialized fields of inquiry. You know, the academy has become a very technical field, and things have gotten more and more distinct, so that we now refer to science and philosophy as very different fields. Broadly speaking, the main difference is that science, of course, is concerned with empirically testable hypotheses about the nature of the world. If you want sort of the broadest definition I think possible of science is this, that it's concerned with understanding conceptually how the world works, and it does so through empirically testable hypotheses. Philosophy, on the other hand, it's a way of thinking more than a field of inquiry. Philosophy is, if you will, a meta field of inquiry. That is, it asks questions that are informed by other fields, including science, and it deploys the tools of logic and argument and reason, broadly speaking, to pursue its own interests. So, for instance, the obvious difference, which is pertinent to my book, is the difference between science and philosophy of science. So science tries to discover things about the world. The philosophy of science tries to figure out how science itself works and what are the epistemic, justification and limits of what human beings can discover about the world. So how do we know things?
You know, one of the things that I like most about at least the first chapter of the book is that you quoted Wittgenstein when you were talking about what philosophy is, and he's quite possibly my favorite philosopher of the past century, if for no other reason, just because of how complex of an individual he was. And the quote that you used was, "Philosophy is a battle against the bewitchment of our intelligence by means of language."
Right.
Would you mind explaining your position on that quote?
It's actually funny. I share your admiration of Wittgenstein, but it's kind of funny that quote comes from him because he's actually a notoriously difficult philosopher to read.
Yes.
But the basic idea is this, that philosophy, in part at least, is about clarifying our concepts and our language. Right, so it is about making distinctions when the distinctions matter or have an import to whatever it is that we're discussing. So the philosopher is somebody who uses the tools again of logic in rigorous language to sort of try to make distinctions. In some sense, philosophical language or philosophical reasoning is similar to the difference between it and standard language is similar to the difference between formal logic or mathematics and standard language. You know, you can say things, explain to people mathematical concepts without using mathematics, but there is a limit and you're bound to be imprecise. And as soon as the concepts, the mathematical concept become complex, you really need to use symbols and equations and things like that. It's the same with philosophy. It is for a lot of cases we can use natural language, you know, whatever your language happens to be, English, Italian, French, Swedish, and so on, to convey certain ideas. But at some point, the ideas become sophisticated, complex enough that they require distinctions that you need a specialized technical language to make, and that is where philosophy comes in. It becomes an attempt to clarify the way we think about certain things to avoid confusions, conceptual confusions that may lead to the wrong conclusion about whatever it is that we're interested in.
The first part of your book seems to be almost solely dedicated to morality and how your thesis of what you call sci-fi can be applied to the question of morality. And morality for me is an extremely interesting subject. It's the thing that I'm delving most into in my studies. But one of the questions that your chapters made me think of is, personally, what would you consider your meta-ethical and normative stances to be?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in Answers for Aristotle, first of all, I use the term sci-fi, which actually arguably could be pronounced sci-fi because it stands for science and philosophy, right? Not science fiction.
True.
But the basic idea, of course, of the book, as you know, is that whenever it comes to, you know, broad issues, broad questions in life, and certainly morality and later on in the book, justice, are two of those big questions. It seems to me that the best way to look for answers, or at least the best way to look for guidance, if not real actual answers, is the combination of the two best intellectual traditions that we've had over the past 2,000 years. One is science, which tells you about, you know, the empirical world, and the other one is philosophy, which tells you about how to think about stuff, including how to think about the world. Now, when it comes to ethics, the question, you're right, is always at some point, well, where do you get your meta-ethics from? Now, the meta-ethics is actually, in fact, a field of philosophy, and it concerns itself with justifying ethical systems. So philosophy recognizes a number of ethical possible approaches to ethics, right? One of them, which I do talk in the book at some point, one of them is, say, utilitarianism, so this idea that you want to maximize people's well-being and minimize suffering. Or another one is deontological systems, this idea that there are rules of conduct that need to be obeyed. Obviously, the most famous kind of deontological system is the Ten Commandments, but there are secular ones like Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative, the idea that something is right if you would agree for that behavior to become a universal law, universal acceptable behavior. And then finally, there's virtue ethics, which goes back to Aristotle, and maybe we can talk about it a little later, but it's really more about a person's character than about what is right and what is wrong. And there are others that I don't mention in the book because, you know, it's a large field. Now, the question is, you know, we can discuss all this stuff, the differences between virtue ethics and deontology and utilitarianism. But at some point, somebody's bound to ask, well, yes, but what makes you think that there is anything, any such thing at all as, you know, answers to moral questions? You know, why do you think that ethics, let's say, is not the same thing as aesthetics or taste, that the difference between right and wrong is just the same difference between whether you like dark chocolate or white or milk chocolate, right? Now, besides the fact that I could obviously answer that there is an objective answer to the question of chocolate, and that is dark. I think that anybody who prefers milk chocolate to dark chocolate, it's crazy. But other than that,
you're so Italian.
Yeah, it's a serious question, right? And so there are different people. Different people have given different answers and articulated different ways of thinking about it. There are people who consider themselves moral realists. These are people who think that ethical questions have universal answers that are in at the very least as universal as, let's say, the laws of logic and mathematics.
That would be me.
Other people that go to the opposite extreme and say, no, it's all about, you know, morality, it's all about of emotions, and these are the emotions that come from being a particular animal of a, you know, social animal of a particular type, and so they're entirely arbitrary and confined to our evolutionary history, the result of our evolutionary history. I take a different approach in the book. And I try, we talked about earlier, I mentioned earlier that one of the points of philosophy is to make distinctions when they matter. And here there is an important distinction that I think does matter. When somebody asks, what about ethics? How do you go about doing ethics? I think they're really asking three distinct questions, two of which have to do with science and one that has to do with philosophy. The first question is, where do we get morality to begin with? Why do we have this really strong feeling when we hear or read about something that we consider wrong? We have this really strong emotional reaction. It's, wow, that is definitely wrong, and you feel very strongly about it. Where does that come from? And I think the answer there is very likely that is coming from evolutionary biology. That is, we developed a sense of morality because we are, in fact, a particular kind of social animal that had to deal with certain dynamics, intra-group and inter-group dynamics throughout our evolutionary history. So I think that's where it comes from. Then you can ask the question, okay, and how does that work? Meaning, how do we human beings engage in moral decision-making? There, the answer, I think, comes mostly, or at least in great part, from neuroscience. Then you have a brain that works in a certain way, and we know, for instance, we can probably talk about more of this later, but we know that there are certain areas of the brain that are involved in this moral decision-making, and we're beginning to understand how complex those areas are and how they interact with each other. Finally, we get to, yes, but what is the right thing to do? I understand that the feeling of morality comes from evolution. I understand that the brain works it out in a certain way, but what am I supposed to do? There, I think the best answer is that ethics is not a body of knowledge. It's a way of reasoning. So what ethics does, when ethical reason, moral philosophy works best, if it's understood as it's a way of thinking logically through the consequences of certain assumptions that we make about life. So let's say that we, for instance, make the assumption that, yes, the point of, our lives are better off, we'd be better off, our societies would be better off if most people's pains were reduced and most people's, happiness was increased. Fine. Then ethics asks, well, what follows from that? What sort of actions are compatible, logically compatible with those axioms? What sort of actions are not logically compatible? And by the way, how do you defend those axioms? What do you mean by well-being? What do you mean by happiness? What do you mean by pain? We're talking about physical pain. We're talking about psychological pain. How do you balance the two? All of those things are questions that you need to sort of reflect about the meaning of what it is that you're trying to do and why you're trying to do it. And that's where you are engaging in ethical thinking, in ethical reasoning.
If I could just ask something about that just quickly, do you think it would be possible to, at some point, and we almost certainly don't have the tools to do it now, but at some point, to be able to quantify all of those variables and put it together into a single statement such that at a point we will be able to say this is almost objectively wrong, this is almost objectively right?
No, I don't think so, although I have to qualify that answer. So, first of all, even if it were possible, Let's say that at some point we figure out a way to scan our brains to the point where we can actually weigh, you know, complex variables that tell us how happy or unhappy a person is, or how much pain that person is psychologically and physically, and so on and so forth. All of that would still not really answer. It would have to inform, of course, our ethical decisions for sure, but it would not decide them because, you know, let's say, you know, let me give you the obvious example. If we think that the goal of life is to make people happy in the sense of increasing certain kinds of stimulations to the brain, well, all you have to do is to hook yourself up to a drug machine and then you'll do that. But most people would think that that is not really what we mean by being happy. And in fact, most people would frown upon that sort of answer, simplistic answers to making people happy. So you still have to discuss the values, the assumptions about your life and the goals that you have in your life. Now, once you develop goals, once you develop an understanding of what you mean by well-being and so on and so forth, then surely some of the answers are going to come from empirical evidence, right? Let me give you a specific example, because otherwise I think sometimes these discussions go a little too esoteric too quickly. Let's say that we're having a debate about abortion, the permissibility of abortion. And let's say that after going back and forth on our philosophical assumptions and examining axioms and all that sort of stuff, we agree that, well, you know, it seems reasonable to permit abortion up to the point in which the fetus begins to feel pain.
Right.
Well, at that point, the next question is, well, when does the fetus begin feeling pain? And that answer is empirical. So that answer has to come from science. You know, a philosopher isn't going to say, well, let me think about it. That is an empirical question. It has to come from the best science that we have available. But the best science isn't going to tell you, or no matter what science you're doing, isn't going to tell you that that is the right criterion. You have to agree that that is the right criterion by reasoning through your values and why certain things are more important than others for you or for us as a society. So there has to be a process of reflection and deliberation. And then if we agree on a specific set of criteria, then we can ask scientists and say, okay, what is the best way to achieve those criteria, to fulfill those criteria? Which, of course, is why, again, the whole idea of Answers for Aristotle is that philosophy needs to be informed by science, just as well as science needs to be done in a way that is philosophically sound and sort of continuous dialogue between the two.
Yeah.
As far as Sound's question, for me personally, I'm a lover of Thomas Nagel's work concerning morality. Not as much concerning the mind, but I do like his work on morality. And one of his essays that he wrote was Subjective and Objective. Mm-hmm. And there's a passage from there that I think is pretty good. He says, the problem is one of opposition between subjective and objective points of view. There is a tendency to seek an objective account of everything before admitting its reality. But often what appears to be to a more subjective point of view cannot be accounted for in this way. So either the objective conception of the world is incomplete, or the subjective involves illusions that should be rejected. And for me, I would prefer the former rather than the latter. And not only that, I would say that it's necessarily incomplete due to our limited abilities to conceive of everything, all possible realities, and all that kind of stuff. So that's
I would agree, and that is one of the reasons why I'm attracted more by things like approaches like virtue ethics than, let's say, utilitarianism or deontology. Utilitarianism and deontology try to take that point of view from nowhere. They try to be, you know, to think of morality as, you know, universal, independent of the individuals, independent of the specific circumstances. Virtue ethics takes a completely different approach. It's much more personal. It's much about you as an individual, you as a person. In fact, what I point out in Answers for Aristotle is that there is a major difference between the way in which the ancient Greeks thought about ethics and the way in which most modern philosophers think about ethics. And that is this. These days, if you ask people, you know, what do you mean by morality or what do you mean by ethics? What is the concern of ethics? They will say, well, try to figure out what is the right thing to do or the wrong thing, not, you know, so the difference between right and wrong. For the ancient Greeks, that would have been puzzling. Because they did not see that as the goal of philosophy or moral philosophy. They saw the goal for them was to answer the question, what kind of life should I live? And from once you have the answer to that question, the answers of whether you should do this or that or the other, it automatically follows. So it's for the Greeks, the question was an issue of personal virtue and personal character. You develop your character as a person. You develop your things like courage, equanimity, you know, fairness, the ability to love people, and so on and so forth. And then everything else follows. You know, because you are a good person, then you do good things. In modern society, we tend to do it to think of it the other way around. That because you do good things or the right thing, then you are a good person. So the causality is entirely switched around. And I tend to, you know, my way of thinking is much more akin to the ancient Greeks. I do think that the fundamental question that we want to ask is what sort of person do we want to be, and then deal with. Well, that kind of person is going to be able to navigate the world, which is much more complex than what can be captured by a set of simple rules like the Ten Commandments or a single criterion and like the utilitarian calculus and that sort of stuff. So virtue ethics, this was a long way to answer your question, but in answer to your question, basically virtue ethics has built in a subjective perspective, but subjective here in the sense not of arbitrary, but in the sense of focused on the subject, focused on you as a person.
Which for me would kind of put a lot of science to be not only its content, but its practice in general to be subjective, like neurobiology would be focused very much on the subject in its research, but that gets into a whole huge conversation as to how you distinguish between objective and subjective, and I don't want to get into that here. We're talking about your book, so
a conversation about that.
That could last for a long time. So to move on, also in this morality part. And I only have actually two more questions about the morality part of the book. So everybody who's tired of morality can rest easy. in this part, you go over what dual process theory is. Would you mind explaining that for everybody?
Yeah. So dual process theory is this idea that you have different ways. In this case, two different ways of processing information about moral questions. This comes out of an interesting convergence between sort of modern neuroscience and philosophy. One of the interesting things about modern neuroscience or cognitive science is that cognitive scientists are discovering a lot of interesting phenomena about the way the human mind works that are actually directly of relevance to the questions that philosophers asked for a long time about morality. And there's two ways of looking at this interaction between neuroscience and philosophy. One of them is, let's say, like somebody like Sam Harris would do, which is, oh, you don't need philosophy. We got neuroscience now. Thank you very much. And the other one is my approach, which is, no, actually, what neuroscience does is it interfaces, it interacts with the philosophical questions, and both disciplines benefit. And sure enough, there's been a lot of interesting research in the last few years that has seen the collaboration between philosophers and neuroscientists. And one of the things that it turned out, for instance, is that we mentioned already two of the major ethical systems or ways of thinking about ethics. One is utilitarianism, and the other one is deontology, or duty-based ethics. Turns out that, funny thing, the brain actually apparently has ways of switching back and forth between thinking as a utilitarian and thinking as a deontologist. And then it has another area, there's other areas of the brain that sort of mediate between the two. And this comes up very, very nicely in experiments that have been done by, again, a combination of neuroscientists and philosophers on the so-called trolley dilemmas. So as you know, the book starts out with an explanation of the trolley dilemma. The trolley dilemma is a classic thought experiment in philosophy, in moral philosophy. And, just like a lot of times in philosophy, philosophers engage in thought experiments. for several reasons. One of them is that they have complete control, of course, of what's going on. And second is because they're very cheap. Top flight experiments don't cost any money, but unlike real experiments. And one of the most famous one is this trolley thing, which essentially works this way. Often in the United States, by the way, I have to explain what a trolley is, because unfortunately public transportation in the United States is such that most cities don't actually have trolleys anymore. But imagine you see this trolley coming down a track, and you realize that it's about to hit five workers on a track, and it's likely going to kill them. But you also realize that you have a lever next to you that if you pull it, it will switch the trolley on a different track where it's going to kill only one worker. And the question there, of course, is, you know, would you pull the lever and, you know, save the five people but kill the one? Now, as it turns out, from a utilitarian perspective, you should do that. It's quite clear because the calculus is easy. You're saving five lives, you're killing one, so you're losing one, so you're saving a net of four lives. From a deontological perspective, the answer is also equally clear, at least from a Kantian perspective, is no, you shouldn't, because you're using somebody else's life as a means to an end, as opposed to an end of themselves. You don't respect them and use them human beings. You're just using them for a purpose. What do actual people do? Well, most people, as it turns out, and this is valid cross-culturally, most people actually will pull the lever. So 80 or 85% of people will pull the lever. Fine. Then the philosopher comes in and says, okay, now I'll give you a different version of the same problem. You still got the five people on one track and one person on the other, but this time you don't have a lever. You're on a bridge. In front of you there is a really big man. You can push him off the bridge to block the trolley. Would you do it? Now, the answer, again, should be yes for the utilitarians and no for the deontologists for the same exact reasons as before. But it turns out that most people actually now switch to a no. They say, no, I'm not gonna do that. And that's puzzling, because that means that there is a huge difference between what a moral philosopher would say based on reasoning. You know, if you're a utilitarian, you'd say yes in both cases. If you're a deontologist, you say no in both cases, and what people actually would do. Well, where does that difference come from? It almost looks like people are switching in their brain from a utilitarian calculus in the first case with the lever to a deontological system of rules in the second case with the bridge. And that's exactly what happens. As it turns out, neuroscientists have discovered that in the first case, most people are engaged their frontal lobe, the areas of the brain that are involved in rational thinking when they decide to pull the lever. But when you ask them about the bridge and pushing directly the man on the tracks, they engage the amygdala, which is an area of the brain that actually has to do much more with emotions. Right, so it's like one where we're switching to this dual processing system, where on the one hand you think like a utilitarian, on the other hand you act or you feel like a deontologist. And this is all very interesting, because it doesn't mean, you know, one interpretation would be, see, the philosophical theories are wrong. Right? You could say, see, that's not what people do, so both utilitarians and deontologists are wrong. But that would be exactly the wrong conclusion to draw from these kind of experiments. What that tells you is that people, especially if they're not trained in philosophical reasoning, they cannot act, they're not going to act consistently from a rational perspective. They will act in one way, thinking about it, in the second case, by reacting emotionally about it. And that's, of course, what it means to be human, so it's fine. It's interesting, however, that once you point out to people that they are, in fact, behaving irrationally, inconsistently between the two, then you force them to sort of think through, and they'll choose one option or the other. They'll say, oh, right, in both cases, I'm doing the same thing, so I really shouldn't push the guy or pull the lever, or yes, I'm doing the same thing, so I really should push the guy or pull the lever. So there's this interesting dynamic between that sort of relates the experiments in neurobiology about how the brain works and what people actually do with the philosophical reflection on what people should do.
So in your book, you actually go over a vast array of evidence. You explained it that we, in fact, do evaluate things under sort of dual process theory.
Right.
But I think one of the philosophical questions that's kind of inevitably asked when you say, well, here's what the science says that we do, is, well, ought we evaluate morality in this way? Just because we innately do, does that mean we should?
Right. No, the answer to that one is simply no. And David Hume was the first one to point out that is a fallacy. Deriving an is from an ought, deriving an ought, that is what you should do based on what is factually the case, is a mistake. And it's very easy to show that that is the case. I mean, you know, there's all sorts, that's called the naturalistic fallacy. You know, thinking that something is right because it is natural. Well, as it turns out, you know, xenophobia and homophobia are natural feelings for human beings because we evolved as a particular kind of social animal. But that doesn't mean that they're the right thing to do. You know, even more trivially, you know, poisonous mushrooms are perfectly natural, but if I were you, I wouldn't eat them. So, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that we do that is not natural. Let's say what we're doing right now, for instance, talking via Skype, using an iPad and or a computer. And yet it turns out that it's, you know, it's an enjoyable and good thing to do. And then there's all sorts of things that are, in fact, natural, but they're not good for us. So there really is no logical – Hume's point was that there is no logical connection between facts and values. That said, of course – it is interesting to see when there is a disconnect between what we think people should do and what people actually do, that is interesting. That means that there is an interesting question there of, you know, why is it that people are not thinking in a certain way, or why is it that people are acting in a way that is contrary to, you know, sort of a rational evaluation of the situation. So that's why I insist in Answers for Aristotle that the science and the philosophy need to be taken in dialogue with each other, and sort of not in opposition to each other. I don't think it makes any sense to try to eliminate philosophical questions by asking the scientists, but at the same time, it doesn't make much sense to ignore what the scientists find about actual human behavior and say, well, you know, we don't care about that because we're just philosophers. So it goes both ways.
So those were all my questions concerning part one of your book. Moving on to part two, you delve a lot into the philosophical question of epistemology. You point out that our brains are not rational. They're not rational things. They don't necessarily lead to rational conclusions, but what they do is they rationalize our positions on a vast array of subjects. Would you mind explaining that for everybody?
Yeah, so Aristotle famously said that human beings are the rational animal, and as it turns out, unfortunately, you might say, modern cognitive science seems to show that we're much better at rationalizing than actually being rational. So we have all sorts of cognitive biases that have been discovered and studied extensively over the last several years by social scientists and psychologists. Things like the confirmation bias. You know, we tend to remember and collect information that is in favor, you know, is congruent with the kind of beliefs that we have, and we tend to discard the information or reject the information that or underestimate the information that actually is contrary to our beliefs. I mean, and you can see that pretty much in every application, you know, in any human setting. I mean, we're in the United States right now. We're in the middle of a political campaign for the presidential elections, and you see this kind of, you know, rationalizing right and left. It's rampant. You almost want to stare at these people and say, "What are you thinking? Do you not realize you just contradicted yourself?" But you know, people have this really strong ability to sort of compartmentalize things. As it turns out, sort of naturally, human beings are much better at rationalizing and convincing themselves, reinforcing their own beliefs and not questioning their own beliefs, rather than thinking about it rationally and dispassionately. That said, we do have, of course, the capacity to think rationally. So there's no need for despair. In fact, it turns out that the cognitive biases that scientists, modern scientists, have discovered and are studying map pretty well with the classification of logical fallacies that philosophers and logicians have come up with over many years. So there's for instance, one of the most typical cognitive biases is that we tend to infer causal connections just because one thing happened after another, right? Because there is a sequence of events, you know, of a particular type. We tend to infer causal connections, such as, for instance, and these often have very practical and often deleterious applications. So, for instance, in the United States, and I hear in part of Europe as well, there is now this debate about whether we should vaccinate children or not. And that whole debate came out of a small but very vocal number of people who simply observed in their own children that the children were vaccinated, and then a few months later or a year or two later, they developed the symptoms of autism. So they drew a causal connection between, you know, A, I vaccinate my child, B, the child develops autism. Now, from a personal perspective, that may make perfect sense, but it is in fact a biased way of thinking, because you don't have independent evidence that there's a causal connection between the two. You simply have two things, one happen after the other. Now, that is also known as a logical fallacy. It's called the post hoc ergo propteroc, which is fancy Latin for after that, therefore because of that. And philosophers have known for a long time that this is, in fact, a fallacious way of reasoning. And now psychologists are discovering that human beings, in fact, often engage in that kind of cognitive bias. Now, what do we do as a result? Well, again, what this tells us is not that philosophy or logic or rational thinking is not important. On the contrary, it tells you that it's even more important. Because it tells you that the logical thinking, critical thinking, does not come natural to human beings. We're not a natural, rational animal, as Aristotle thought. But we're capable of doing it through hard training. You know, one of the first things you want to do is to be aware of your problems. So once you know about cognitive biases, and once you know about the correct way of thinking, in other words, once you've studied both psychology and philosophy, then presumably you're going to be a better, you know, better equipped to avoid falling into the same trap again. So I think that this whole idea that is now very fashionable these days, that again, oh well, cognitive science is replacing philosophy or showing that philosophy is not really relevant because human beings automatically come with all these biases, it's exactly the wrong way to look at it. What these discoveries do is precisely the opposite. They point out even more strongly to how important it is to teach our kids critical thinking and about logic.
I always get a little bit of a chuckle whenever you say, you know, neurobiology is trying to replace philosophy in the minds of some people, because I'm aware that you have a bit of a stigma with Sam Harris. So I just know that that's kind of where that's coming from in a way. So I don't know, it just kind of makes me laugh a little bit. To continue, in part two, you also expound on a topic that's the title of actually one of your chapters, intuition versus rationality. You say intuition is a good thing, it's a useful tool, but it should be viewed as sort of a hypothesis maker rather than a reality decider. Paraphrasing it in my own words. Would you mind explaining what you mean by that?
So intuition often is referred to as sort of almost as a mystical thing. You know, people say, "Oh, I'm very intuitive." As it turns out, again, cognitive scientists can study intuition, and they've done so. Intuition is best thought of as the result of fast subconscious processing of information by the brain. So the brain, again, has, in this case, two different sort of modes of action. One is subconscious, fast, and essentially when we're unaware of it, and that's what we call intuition. And the other one is slow, but it's conscious, it's deliberate, and we are obviously very much aware of it. Now, the idea is that it's not that one is better than the other, is that, once again, the human mind works better when the two actually interact with each other. Intuitions are good for providing you a possible way to answer a question or for providing you a quick heuristic, a quick answer where you don't have time to reflect and to think about it and to sort of lay down all the options and so on and so forth. But intuition is also sloppy. it may bring a solution that is quick and yet wrong. And so if you do have the time, the idea is that you really should try to figure out what the exact reasoning is. Now, I said intuition has been studied in different groups of people. Perhaps the most famous type of studies on intuition come from the study of chess players. And it turns out that you can compare the intuitions of, let's say, novice player with the intuitions of expert players, and then the intuition of expert players with the intuitions of grandmasters. And it turns out that, for instance, grandmasters, you can put a grandmaster in a situation, let's say you set out a chessboard with the game that is already started. It's already at some point, and the person has not actually played that game. You put the chessboard in front of the chess master, and you say, okay, what will be your next move under those circumstances? And something interesting happens there. First of all, the chess master very likely will give you an immediate answer, because he has an ability to sort of, he or she has an ability to sort of grasp the situation, again, intuitively, and come up with an answer. And then you say, okay, why did you do that? You know, what justifies your move? And you'll see that the person actually has to stop and think about it and reconstruct the logic. And the reason for that is because the logic was, in fact, subconscious. Okay, so you have to actually think about it slowly and say, okay, I probably did that because. Now, that by itself would sort of seem to suggest that we should therefore trust our intuitions, and then the thinking later is just icing on the cake. But there is a second experiment that people have done also with chess masters that shows the limits of intuition. So you can put a chess master in a situation that would actually not occur naturally on a chessboard. Okay, and then you ask them the question, in other words, it wouldn't develop organically from an actual game. And then you can ask them, well, what would you do there? And the guy is stumped. He has no answer. There's no intuition that he has about that sort of situation because it's not part of his experience. And if there is, in fact, any way out of that particular, that artificial situation, he will actually have to think about it carefully and deliberately. So the basic idea is that intuition essentially is our way of processing information about situations with which we're very familiar. The more familiar you are with a certain situation, the more your intuitions are refined, which means that there is no such a thing as a generally intuitive person. As I said, when people tell you, oh, I'm an intuitive person, that means nothing. But there is such a thing as domain-specific intuition. You can be intuitive about chess playing if you spend thousands of hours playing chess. You can be intuitive about, nursing, for instance, in a hospital if you spend thousands of hours in a hospital, and so on and so forth. So intuition is domain specific. And the idea is that, however, again, if possible, you always want to sort of deliberately check the answers that your intuition suggests. Look, there is an analogy in philosophy of science which is very interesting. Philosophers of science make a distinction between what they call the context of discovery and the context of justification in science. So the context of discovery is the question of, how do scientists come up with new ideas? And frankly, we don't have a good response to that. If you ask scientists themselves, they'll say, well, I got up the other day and I just had the idea. Or I went and took a shower after I worked on a problem for many hours and then all of a sudden the answer came to me. Or, I went on a trip and took a vacation and then suddenly I had this flash of inspiration. So ideas are generated by the human subconscious in ways that are pretty much unpredictable, at least at the current level of our understanding of neurobiology. That's what philosophers of science call the context of discovery. And philosophy has very little to say about the context of discovery. That really is the area of neuroscience, cognitive science. However, then, every scientist would say, yeah, but once that I had the idea, I had to go out and check it out, see if it actually was a good idea. Just because it felt like a good idea, that doesn't mean that it was a good idea. So now you have to do, the actual calculations or the actual experiment or whatever it is. To verify that idea. That's what the philosophers of science call the context of verification. There you use logic. There you use the tools of reasoning, assessing evidence in a rational way and so on and so forth. And that's where philosophy actually does have a lot to say about how you should do that sort of thing. So there's a nice distinction there. The context of discovery turns out to be the domain largely of cognitive science, and the context of justification turns out to be the domain of philosophy. Similarly, for everyday human interactions, intuition has to do very much with our innate ability to come up with quick decisions, while logical reason thinking has to do with how well we are trained in thinking rationally about certain situations.
Actually, if anybody is confused at all about it, they're still unclear as to this distinction, I think there's an old story about something that Wittgenstein once said that can help a lot. The ancient Greeks felt that their intuitions told them that the sun revolved around the earth, because that's kind of what it looked like. But as Wittgenstein famously said, what did they expect it to look like if it was the other way around? So the thing about that is your intuitions can tell you something that seems to be true. And the more you're educated in philosophy, science, critical thinking in general, it's a lot easier to evaluate as to whether or not your intuitions are in fact correct.
Right. Yeah, that is the case. And I should add another point here, which is important about these discussion that we're having about the relative roles of, let's say, cognitive science and philosophy. And that is that philosophers of science particularly recently have begun to agree that science in especially, but sort of general critical thinking, is actually a social activity. So that individual human beings have biases, and those biases are the one, you know, cognitive biases. They're studied by psychologists. But it's our best bet to soften or filter out those biases as much as possible is by engaging in social dialogue, because it is other people with different convictions and with different ideologies and with different agendas that are going to point out what the problem is in our reasoning. I mean, this is the basis of peer review in the academia, right? In science, in technical philosophy, in technical any technical field, you have peer review. Well, the concept, the idea of a peer review, the review is exactly that. You may think you have the best ideas, and you may even have thought about it, and you're convinced that they are really, your idea is really good. But let's see what other experts, what other people in that area say, and how they evaluate your work, and then we'll get closer to a sort of a more objective, or I should say, less subjective state of knowledge. So science in general, and even more broadly, sort of discussions about critical thinking, critical discussions are a social activity. That is why it's important to engage socially, particularly with people that disagree with you.
I have a lot more questions here, but in about 9 minutes or so, we're going to go ahead and hand the questions over to others who have more scientific questions for you. So I'm going to move on to a chapter that I really, really enjoyed, which was The Hormones of Love. That you wrote. You go in depth about the current philosophical theories about love, what it is, how it works, why we love, all that. Clearly, we can get into science, of what seems to be love, examine a person's brain when they're in love, dopamine levels, whatever other chemicals take place whenever we feel some sort of connection with other people. You do analyze that in the book, by the way, in case anybody is wondering if it's just kind of glossed over. He goes in depth the science of that. The question I have about that is, and I don't recall seeing an answer in this, but I might have just glossed over it. What is sort of the defining characteristic that makes loving someone distinct from liking somebody? Because you say later in the book that an obvious difference between someone you love and someone that you like or you're friends with is that you tend to have sex with someone that you love.
That's right.
But I don't think really that's completely true. As you point out, there's also unrequited love, and there's also the love that we feel for family members and other people for whom we consider to at least be sort of like family. So.
Right. See, that's where I think, again, language gets in the way, right, and as Wittgenstein kept reminding us. The unfortunate thing is that, especially in English, there is one word only for all those things, and that's love. But a lot of other languages actually have distinct words for those different kinds of emotions. And, in fact, the ancient Greeks famously recognized at least three different types of what we would call today love. And one had to do what was called Eros, and it had to do with romantic, with the modern version would be romantic love, you know, relationships and that sort of stuff. Then there was a philia, which was the kind of love you have for friends and family members. And then there was agape, which is the kind of love that you have for ideas, like the idea of your country or the idea of God or the idea of reason or the idea of whatever it is that you care about. And clearly those are very distinct. They are related emotions because in all cases you can feel, we can feel very strongly about the object of our love, but the way we relate to those objects is very different. The way you relate to a friend is different from the way you relate to a lover, and it is different from the way you relate to an abstract idea. So, again, the Greeks there were making interesting distinctions that I think would actually be helpful in modern discussions about love. Now, your specific question was about, you know, what makes a difference between, say, a relationship and a friendship. And there are some interesting differences. One of them is typically the one you mentioned, which is, you know, with somebody you have a relationship with, you typically have sex, not necessarily. And with friends, you typically don't, although that, too, is not necessarily the case. But, you know, broadly speaking, that seems to be true, at least in Western societies. And that, by the way, that's a difference that doesn't, that, that we better not underestimate, because, of course, having sex means that you have it obviously very intimate, not only physical, but emotional, you know, relationship with that person, the kind of thing you don't have with most other people in your life. So the physical act in itself, when it is accompanied by the circumstances and sort of the certain kinds of feelings, it makes a huge difference. It's not to be underestimated. Nonetheless, that's not the only difference. So one other difference is that, for instance, in Answers for Aristotle, I point out that there can definitely be such a thing as unrequited love, but there's no such a thing as unrequited friendship. You know, you cannot imagine, you can imagine loving somebody and that person not loving you back, but you can't imagine being a friend of somebody and that person not being a friend back, because it's a different kind of relationship. Friendship are a type of relationship that is inherently more interactive, if you will. It can't be one way. You simply cannot consider yourself somebody else's friend unless you actually have, so to speak, authorization from that person, because it's reciprocated. On the other hand, you can fall in love with somebody. Even at a distance, you can develop the kind of eros feeling even at a distance without that person even knowing, for instance, that you fell in love. Although, if the person doesn't know, you probably are a sociopath of some sort. But
anyway. Oi, don't judge.
Let's not judge.
I'm going through that at the moment, so back off.
All right. So you're in love. Are you telling me that you're in love with somebody who doesn't know that?
Sort of.
Okay, let's not go there.
I have spoken to this person.
Yeah, but I mean, there clearly is something unusual about that sort of, you know, unidirectional relationship, but it is possible. In a friendship, on the other hand, it just doesn't seem to make much sense to even say that, like, oh, I'm friends with this guy, but this guy doesn't know me. Well, what do you mean by friend then? And, of course, even friendships are a different type, and there Aristotle was also very perceptive. Aristotle was not just an excellent, obviously, philosopher. He was also a good psychologist, especially for the time. We're talking 2,400 years ago. You know, he had a pretty good understanding, grasp of human psychology. And one of the things that he did was to make a distinction between different kinds of friends. And he said, for instance, you know, you can have, of course, what we today would call acquaintances, but you could be a friend with a coworker, say, for instance, or somebody at work. But that friendship, the defining component of that friendship is actually your work relations. And on top of that, you know, the guy might be nice or the woman might be nice. And so you develop a feelings of friendship. But the defining component of that relationship remains the business one. That's very different from a friend in the more intimate sense of the word, where you develop a much more personal relationship with that individual. And for Aristotle, the best thing about friendship is the good friends are supposed to hold up a mirror to ourselves and help us improve our character, right? Because our friends are intimate enough that they should be able to tell us that we're doing something wrong or that we could be doing something better. That's what friendship really is for Aristotle. The idea that you can improve each other. Now, of course, as you know, in the book I also talk about the fact that today we live in an environment where we have, you know, thousands of friends on Facebook, for instance. Well, they're really not friends in none of the above categories. They're people you interact with. And by the way, I think that's important. I think actually that having an extended network of people that one interacts with more or less directly is actually an important innovation. I'm not one of those people that criticize social networks just for the hell of it. I think that just like any new technology, the social networking has advantages and disadvantages and has problems and it has benefits. So I certainly wouldn't discount the interesting fact that we live in a society where we can, in fact, have regular interactions with people we don't know across the world. I think that's overall it's a positive. But clearly those are not friends. A friend for Aristotle is somebody you actually spend a lot of time with, you get to know personally, and you know to the point of being able and comfortable with holding that mirror in front of him and that makes him aware of the kinds of things that you could do better, to be a better human being.
Well, it's about 3 o'clock now. We're halfway through the interview, and I know people kind of want to get into the science stuff. So I'm going to go ahead and withhold the rest of my questions until we have a bit of dead time. If questions run dry, and hand this over to our scientific experts, which would include Kitch and Sound, and I suppose Marty and with his old physics thing.
All right, bring it on.
Sorry, I'm just going to butt in there just to say we've just been featured, so if you're watching this, please join in. It's an interesting discussion we're having here. Dr. Massimo Pigliucci, we're discussing philosophy and science. So I'll hand over to the scientists now.
Excellent. Now that all that wishy-washy hand-waving stuff's out of the way. So I want to say it's nice because I've always been sort of strictly empirical and Lundy's always been quite strictly philosophical, and it's nice to have a happy medium on the show.
Yes, exactly. That's a basic idea, right.
But I don't know if Kitch, if you want to kick things off or...
Sure. I've been just as recently during the week just going to Dr. Pigliucci's papers on phenotypic plasticity. And the first question I just want to ask, just so we can get the audience up to date, is what exactly is phenotypic plasticity and what's its importance to evolution and natural selection?
Okay, and you say we only have an hour, right? So phenotypic plasticity is a technical term in evolutionary and developmental biology that refers to the fact that genes and environments interact constantly throughout an individual's life to shape that individual's features and behavior, okay? So it's a gene-environment interaction issue. Now, plasticity in particular is it's quantifiable. It's actually a mathematical function often. It's often represented as a mathematical function that essentially quantifies the ability of a particular set of genes, so a particular genotype, to react differently to different environmental conditions. So to give you a couple of specific examples about human beings. So there are some features about humans that are very non-plastic, that is that they are invariant regardless of the environment. And then there are other things that are very plastic, even though they do have a genetic component. So for instance, the number of eyes that we have, typically it's 2, and it typically doesn't change with the environment. You know, you can grow in Sweden or in Africa. You can grow in very high temperature, very low temperature. You can eat these things or eat that other thing. It doesn't matter. You're going to develop 2 eyes unless you have a mutation or a developmental defect. So eyes, the number of eyes, is very non-plastic in human beings. On the other hand, of course, height, for instance, is very plastic. So it is certainly the case that height is influenced by genes. You know, there are genes that affect, let's say the human growth hormone, and therefore they will regulate the final height of an individual. But we also know that height is very much responsive to the environment, in particular to diet, to the quality and quantity of things that we eat, especially in certain during development at certain ages. So that would be an example of a very plastic trait. Now, the reason this is important has become more and more important in evolutionary biology is because up until a few decades ago, biologists thought of plasticity as noise, as something to be avoided or minimized and, you know, got rid of it so that you could study the real thing, which was the genetics of an organism. So for most of the early part of the 20th century, for instance, up to way into the, in fact, up to the 1970s and 80s, the focus in evolutionary biology was on genes. It was on genetics. It was on describing evolution as a process of natural selection, selecting certain characteristics in a population because they're adaptive, and those genes that produce those characteristics were favored, the genes that did not produce those characteristics were eliminated, and that's how evolution works. Turns out that's only a part of the story. I mean, that is true, but it's only part of the story. Beginning with the 1980s, late 70s and early 80s, people have begun to realize more and more that actually what happens there is that natural selection, sometimes at least, selects for genes that have a more plastic behavior because it is adaptive. It is advantageous for the organism to actually produce different phenotypes, that is, different morphologies or different behaviors, depending on the environment. And so what selection sometimes favors is, in fact, plasticity. It's a high level of degree of plasticity. It's a high degree of flexibility, basically, in the developmental repertoire of an organism. So the reason plasticity is important is because it really is a concept that bridges the gap between genetics and developmental biology. Genetics is obviously about what genes do, but development is a process that is the result of the continuously interacting action of genes and environments, and that action is captured by the concept of phenotypic plasticity.
I know that, well, we've now only got 55 minutes left, but I know that another field that you're into which ties in with that is, epigenetics. Weirdly enough, I've only just really encountered epigenetics for the first time this week, so it's a small world, but could you just explain briefly what epigenetics is?
Yeah, so epigenetics is a field, it's an area of study in biology that has also exploded in the last, even more recently than phenotypic plasticity, in the last maybe 10 years or so. Epigenetics refers to the fact that there are some effects that alter the development of organisms that are not due to genes directly. They're due to epigenetic processes. The term epigenesis means beyond the gene. And so these are other molecules, they're not genes, that affect development. And sometimes they affect development in a way that is dependent on the environment. So, for instance, the classical example of epigenetic effects is the fact that certain areas of the genome are often modified chemically. They are methylated. There is a methyl group, which is an alcohol group, attached to the beginning of the gene, and if the gene is methylated, that gene does not get transcribed, so it doesn't work. It's turned off, basically. So the methylation effects are ways of turning on and off certain genes throughout development. That in itself is interesting because it tells you something about how is it exactly that genes work. You know, what turns them on and off or modulates their action? Why is it that some genes are activated in certain tissues and not in others, or they're activated at certain times in during development of an organism and not others, and so on and so forth? So epigenetics has been important now for a number of years as a way of understanding gene regulation, essentially. But what is making it even more interesting more recently is that people have discovered that in certain species, at least, some epigenetic effects can be inherited from one generation to another. So if you're this famous example in humans, for instance, where people have discovered that the growth ability, the height, let's say, and even the intellectual development, the brain development of individuals is affected not only by the conditions, environmental conditions of their mothers, their parents, but of their grandmothers. And it's hard to imagine, you know, in the case of mothers, it's rather easy to imagine that, well, if the mother was, undernourished, let's say, during pregnancy, that may have had consequences on the development of the fetus, and so it's kind of easy to imagine how the adult human being might still reflect, the development of the adult human being might still reflect those conditions. But how do you explain the effect of grandmothers? And the idea is that some of these things actually, some of these effects are transmitted not genetically, but epigenetically. The grandmother were experiencing certain environment, let's say poor nutrition. That environmental input has changed the status of certain epigenetic markers. They have, some of their genes have been modulated on or off, and that status gets inherited across one or two or sometimes more generations, which means that literally part of the reason you develop the way you develop, both physically and mentally, is the result not only of your genes, not only of your environment, but also of the genes and the environments experienced by your parents and your grandparents. And that's a pretty interesting discovery right there.
Yeah, and I know it's sort of quite early days to be asking this question, but what sort of implications does that have for evolutionary theory?
That's very much up to, for discussion. So there are some people who claim that, well, these things are really not that relevant to evolution because epigenetic effects, even when they are inherited, they are short-term. And so they sort of get washed out by other processes such as natural selection on genetic alleles, genetic variants. That's one way of looking at it. Other people are saying, well, actually, we begin to have empirical evidence that some of these epigenetic effects last for a number of generations, in some cases even hundreds or thousands of generations, so they become clearly evolutionarily relevant at that point, because that means that there is a second system of inheritance, that there is a genetic system of inheritance, and then there is an epigenetic system of inheritance. So things become more complicated. The evolutionary process becomes more complicated. And then there is a third group to which I actually belong that sort of mediates between these opposite tendencies. And I tend to think with other people that, yeah, very likely the majority of heritable epigenetic effects is short-term, but that doesn't mean it's evolutionarily irrelevant because, you know, natural selection happens every generation. It's not like evolution happens only in the long run. Evolution happens generation by generation. And if the presence of a particular epigenetic effect makes it more or less likely that, say, an individual will survive or a population will go extinct, that does have an impact in evolutionary dynamics. Now, how much that impact is depends on a bunch of other factors, and it probably varies from species to species, and it's very much an open empirical question. I, at this point, I wouldn't bet too much on one way or another. The bottom line, I think, it's twofold. One, we have discovered epigenetic effects, some of which are heritable. Right there, that's a big deal because it helps us understanding development and how gene and environments interact to form the adult individual. And on the other hand, there clearly is in some sort of effect in terms of evolution, but we don't know how much and how prevalent it is.
Right. Kitch, I think you were trying to say something a few minutes ago when I asked my last question.
Actually, I was going to. Funny enough, I was actually about to ask the same question.
Okay.
Make mine think alike.
Should I get the same answer?
I don't know what this business is with giving human examples, because I understood that you work mainly in plants, which would make you a man after my own heart.
Ah, yes. Well, yes, when I was a practicing biologist, I worked on experimentally on plants for a couple of reasons. First of all, because I like flowers. And second of all, because they're easy to manipulate. And, you know, they don't have blood, they don't scream, they stay in place, you know, that sort of stuff. So my actual experimental work was on plants. But I've always been interested in sort of the broader conceptual implications of whatever it is that I was studying, you know, that be phenotypic plasticity or epigenetic effects. And so I always keep up with the literature in sort of the broader sense. And now, particularly that I switched professionally to philosophy of science, you know, one of the things that allows me to do is to be much more broad in terms of the literature that I can follow, because I obviously don't have to do the experiments anymore. Now other people do the experiments, and I just read about them and then think about the implications of those things. So, yeah, and when it comes to talking to the public about these things, quite frankly, you know, most of us, you know, human beings tend to be narcissistic. We're interested in ourselves. and so it's always good to give examples that include human beings.
Yeah, I disagree personally. But,
Myself, I work with a variety of cell lines. I just want to ask about is there any difficulties working with plants?
Yes, there are, because, you know, especially if you're working with flowering plants, which is what I was doing, you know, the generation time, for instance, tends to be pretty long. So if you do genetics, you don't get to do long-term experiments in terms of, you know, laboratory selection in the laboratory, things like that, because unlike fruit flies, plants take months to years to go to flower, and so to get a next generation takes much longer. That said, most of my research, not all of it, but most of my research was on a plant called Arabidopsis, which is a small plant that belongs to the mustard family, although it has white flowers instead of yellow ones. And one of the nice things about Arabidopsis is they call it the Drosophila botanica. Drosophila, of course, is the fruit fly. So the botanical fruit fly, because it has a fast generation time, so you can do genetic experiments and molecular biology experiments. It's not quite as fast as a fruit fly. Fruit flies can go from one generation to another in about a week or 10 days. Arabidopsis can take, several weeks to a few months, but still, by the standard of plants, it's actually pretty fast. Now, of course, if you're talking about efficiency in terms of generation time, the best thing to do then is working with bacteria or even viruses, because they go from one generation to another literally in a matter of hours. But I think that they're much less cute than flowering plants.
Quite difficult to study as well. It's quite difficult to see any kind of effects on a single-celled organism.
That's right. That's the other thing, that, you know, obviously viruses and bacteria are single-celled organisms. In fact, there's even a discussion whether viruses are organisms or not. But certainly bacteria are single-celled, so there's no development. And so there's a lot less interesting things going on there. By the same token, that's also one of the things that makes them much easier to study, which is what, you know, the bacterial genetics is very advanced compared to other areas of genetics.
Right. I'll just quickly check with Zulu. Did you say that we will be open to questions for the last 45 minutes?
I'll let you run on for another bit, like 15 minutes till half past, okay?
Okay, then.
All right.
Actually, one thing I really wanted to ask a scientist that when we got them on is, what makes a good scientific paper, outside of the fact that it has no bunk in it, has no crap in it? But what actually makes an interesting paper to read?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think that, for one thing, part of it has to do with the topic. Right? I mean, you can write a very nice paper, you know, very cogently argued and based with good data and all that. But if nobody cares about the particular topic, it's hard to imagine that paper will be cited a lot of times. And, you know, there's a lot of scientific literature that never gets cited or very rarely gets cited. But on the other hand, you can also imagine easily a very, very sexy topic, or, you know, very something people should be interested in, and it's written dreadfully, and it's very heavy and difficult to understand, and people are also not going to get through it. So I think that the combination for a very good scientific paper is the topic has to be important, has to be something that captures people's imaginations and interest, and the style of writing has to be, elegant, but not in the sense of being sort of rococo or, you know, baroque, but in the sense of being the kind of things that captivates you. Unfortunately, there is a tendency in scientific circles to write in a very dry, very impersonal fashion, which makes reading most scientific papers incredibly boring, even if you're interested in the topic. It's very rare, but it does happen that you do find people who get away with or are capable of writing papers that are actually engaging, and you really sort of they're page turners, and you really want to get to the end of it and figure out what happened.
I'll just say as well. Oh, sorry, you trying to say something, Mitch?
No, I just wanted to make a little comment about the idea of people making their writing a little more interesting for people. As far as scientific papers go, the problem I see with that is you end up with the controversy like what Richard Lewontin went through decades ago, where he decided to sort of kind of add a little bit of his opinion on a scientific paper that he wrote, and then he got widely criticized. Like, that's not part of the science. Don't do that. That you just leave that away, leave that alone. That's not what you're supposed to be doing. And so that, I think that's probably the reason why a lot of scientists probably steer clear of, well, not just that instance, but things like that happening would probably be the reason why scientists steer clear of more colorful dialogue in their
I have to say, first of all, Richard Lee Wontin was a major influence on my scientific career. I actually been interested in gene-environment interactions and phenotypic plasticity precisely because I read a paper by Lee Wontin, which was published in 1974. I read it about 10 years later when I was in college, but he was a big influence. And the nice thing is that I had the privilege years later when I was in graduate school at the University of Connecticut to actually tell him because he came for a seminar in the department and we met for about an hour. And it's always nice to say, you know, I mean, the reason I'm here, one of the major reasons I'm here is because I read a paper that you wrote, you know, 20 years ago. So I have a particular sort of sympathy for Lee Wontin, even though sometimes I actually disagree with the stuff that he writes. Now, back to the point of style, however, and sort of content and all that in a scientific paper. Yes, you're right. A lot of scientists have what in philosophy is known as a positivistic attitude toward science. They like this idea that science is objective or strives at least for objectivity, and therefore that anything that smells of personal opinion or judgment or analysis, that it's not tightly related, you know, connected to the result, the actual empirical data. It's fluff and it's not science. I tend to disagree. I mean, that's a naive way, actually, of looking at science. And sociologists of science have shown increasingly over the last few years that is simply not the way in which science works. I mean, when you read a scientific paper, the way it's written, it's very formal, right? It starts out with an introduction which sets out the general topic, and then there's a section called materials and methods when you explain what sort of experiments you've done, how you did the measurements, what kind of data analysis you did. It's all very dry. And then there's a results section where you basically have a summary of the results in terms of, you know, which you present as tables and figures and so on and so forth. And then finally there is a discussion where you're supposed to bring back the results to the topics that you introduce in the introduction and sort of come up with some broad analysis and general conclusions about what you've done. Now, this is all very nice and dandy, but it's a work of fiction. Science doesn't work that way. You know, you don't start actual laboratory experiments or research programs in that way. You know, I think broadly about the big question, then I set up the experiment, then I do the analysis, and then I finally reconnect everything at the end. That's much too linear of a process. The reality is much more messy. It's much more, you know, complicated and much more of a human endeavor than it feels like if you read a scientific paper. So this idea that, oh, you shouldn't introduce opinions or sort of subjective points of view in a paper because it's all about objectivity is definitely naive. Now, that said, you don't want to go overboard either. I mean, presumably the discussion of in a paper is the area where you should be, in fact, sort of broadening the context and talking about the more general implications of what you think came out of your work. And I think you should be allowed to have some leeway in both the style and the content, but of course up to a point. I mean, you don't want to start all of a sudden studying, you know, you've done an experiment on, let's say, you know, the genetics of flowering time in a plant, and all of a sudden you start talking about the effects of Marxism in modern society. I mean, clearly that's not acceptable. That's going a little too far.
No, I quite agree. I might have to have a chat with you afterwards about how to write a good scientific paper, because I'm shortly going to have to start writing my own. I'll just say as well that you are quite famously an advocate of promoting good science and good science education to the public, and also you are quite an outspoken critic of creationism. Why is it that matters to you so much personally? Does it go back to what you were saying earlier about rationality and about informed judgment-making and informed decision-making? Do you think that evolution, or other proponents of creationism, seek to undermine sort of rational conclusion-making processes?
Yeah, so that comes out of two things. First of all, I have a passion for rationality and truth. I know that the word passion and rationality usually don't go together, but I think that's because of, you know, caricatures of the rational rational people, like in the Spock character in Star Trek. Right? If you're rational, you're obviously not emotional. Baloney. Rational people can be just as emotional as anybody else, and in particular, they can be emotional about rationality. They can care about things. This goes back to David Hume once again, one of my favorite, I should say my favorite philosopher, who famously said that, you know, reason is and ought to be the slave of passions, by which he meant that unless you give a damn about something, you're not going to get engaged with it. So I get engaged in writing for the public and in advocating for science and reason because I am passionate about it. That said, so that's a general idea, but the reason this thing got started to begin with, in my case, is a pure accident of personal history. Turns out that in late 95, early 96, I moved to the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, where I was then a faculty for 9 years. And the second semester that I was there, I opened the newspaper and I discovered that the Tennessee legislature was trying to pass a equal time for creation law. And I was in disbelief. I said, what? A creation? What are they talking about? And then I realized, of course, that, oh, right, I'm in the middle of the Bible Belt here. it's a whole different thing. You know, Knoxville, Tennessee, it's only 40 miles away from Dayton, Tennessee, where the Scopes trial happened and, you know, took place in 1925, the first trial about the teaching of evolution. So all of a sudden, all these things started hitting, and I said, no, come on, we got to do something about it, and that's why I started doing public talks and writing about public education and public understanding of science. But up to that point, quite frankly, the issue has simply not come to my, you know, to my radar screen. When I was growing up in Europe, in Italy, I never met a creationist. My religious views were completely uncontroversial. I simply went about doing my business and doing my job without even thinking about these sort of things. And even when I moved to the United States back in 1990, I spent my first few years there in New England, where, again, these issues did not come up. But then I moved to the South, and they did come up. And now all of a sudden, I became aware of a national problem, because as it turns out, once you start paying attention, creationists are everywhere. And, you know, almost I think every single one of the 50 states in the United States has had at one point or another to deal with a legal challenge brought up by creationists or against creationists. And so then I realized that not only this is a problem, but it's actually a part of a much broader issue about people believing all sorts of nonsense, which is why a couple of years ago I wrote Nonsense on Stilts about pseudoscience and the harm that it can do. Because most people, you know, the first thing when I started talking to my friends about, oh, you know, I'm getting involved about writing about pseudoscience and that sort of stuff, they said, well, why bother? You know, first of all, not many people believe that sort of stuff, and then it doesn't have any effect. And I said, no, wrong, factually wrong on both counts. First of all, a lot of people believe that stuff. You know, in the United States, you know, 60%, 55 to 60% of people believe that the Earth was created 6,000 years ago. That's a huge percentage of the population. And also, believing in nonsense does have repercussions, both personal, like, you know, people who think that, despite the lack of evidence, they think that vaccines cause autism, they're not going to vaccinate their kids, which means that their kids' health is going to be in jeopardy, and also because of a herd effect. Of course, the population at large is going to be affected. So these things have actually, they matter. They have consequences. In Africa, millions of people have been dying of HIV/AIDS over the last several years, in part because several African governments refuse to believe that there is a connection between HIV and AIDS, and they think that, you know, they can cure it with murky liquids and vitamin extracts and that sort of stuff. So pseudoscience literally kills. In some cases, and it certainly hurts a lot of people, and a lot of people believe it. And so that's why I think that actually, you know, I spend a significant amount of my time writing and talking to the public about these things, because I do think it makes a difference. And it certainly makes much more of a difference than publishing yet another technical paper that, you know, five people are going to cite in the technical literature.
Just wanted to move on from but now that we're into pseudoscience, you have debated Kent Hovind, well, not debated, I don't like saying that term, had a discussion or educated or tried to educate Kent Hovind for your sins. Yeah. How did that come about? Or how did you manage to keep calm during that debate?
Well, so I actually debated or tried to educate Kent Hovind a number of times, and he wasn't the only one. I also debated five times, I think, Duane Gish, who is one of the major figures of the Institute for Creation Research, so oxymoronically called. And, you know, it was an interesting experience. I did that several years ago, again, when I was living in the South, where these things are particularly popular. And there are a couple of things you realize immediately when you do debates. First of all, the point of the debate is not to convince your opponent, because Kent Hovind, as far as I can tell, is uneducatable. There's no way to educate Kent Hovind. What you're doing there, and in fact, you're not even trying to educate most of their supporters. What you're trying to do is to reach people who are in the middle ground, the fence sitters, people who may have heard of the debate, they don't know much about it, and they're curious and they want to learn something. So the major reason to do debate is to reach the middle ground or, frankly, to energize your own troops, you know, to give sort of more emphasis and more, you know, to some extent, infusion of energy to students and colleagues and who actually care about public education and they're involved in it. So that's one thing. The second thing you learn is that debates are not won on the basis of argument. They're won on the basis of rhetoric and of personality. That is true for political debates just as much as it's true for debates about public education. So one mistake that I've seen a lot of my colleagues make is to think that, oh, well, it's not going to take much to debate a creationist because they're, you know, a bunch of idiots who don't know what they're talking about. And so, you know, I'm the scientist. I'm going to go up there and solve the problem, you know, tell them exactly what to think. It doesn't work that way at all. Most of these people are very skilled at debating. They have very well-honed rhetorical skills, and they come across as friendly, which the public likes. A lot of scientists come across as aloof and, you know, not particularly in touch with people and so on and so forth. I mean, one of the most frequent comments that I got from people after debates, from people on the other side, so people that were skeptical of my positions, was, well, I still disagree with you, but it's nice to see that you're a nice guy. You know, like, they were expecting the scientists to be sort of eating babies for breakfast. So the best contribution actually you can do in those cases is simply to show people that, look, I'm just one of you guys. You know, it's the same thing. I got two arms and two legs and two eyes and so on. I don't eat babies. I'm just trying to do my job and to, you know, to have a reasoned discussion about these things. So debates are important. I think they need to be engaged in because they are one way to reach certain segments of the public that would be very likely otherwise unreachable. But they're certainly not the only thing you want to do, or even arguably the major thing you want to do. I think that the serious public education is done, first of all, in formal settings, you know, at pre-college education. I think that the most fundamental thing that we can do if we want to improve public education and public understanding of science is to do it at a pre-college level, because by the time people come to college, it's almost too late. So there's no reason why our kids couldn't start learning the basics of science and, frankly, the basis of critical thinking and, you know, philosophical argument in elementary school, and certainly no reason why they couldn't do that in middle school and in high school. So that's, I think, the major area, major arena where really improvements in public education is going to come from. The second arena is through writings and public talks and so on and so forth. But the debates also do have, I think, they also play a role. And by the way, I know that one of the objections by some of my colleagues, including, let's say, Richard Dawkins, for instance, to doing debates is that way you give a platform to the other side. I mean, that's a very misguided way of looking at things. Usually it's the other side that gives us a platform, because most scientists, you know, Dawkins is probably an exception, but most scientists never get to talk to the public or very rarely do so. So if you engage in a debate, that actually is one of the few times where the public is actually going to come out and listen to you. and what you have to say. So it's a worthwhile activity within limits, and if you do it the right way, which, as I said, needs to take care not just of the factual evidence and of the arguments, but also of the rhetoric and frankly, even your demeanor during the debate.
I definitely agree with the public education system, getting critical thinking in there, because I know from my own country in Ireland that the science curriculum is more about learning off the science instead of actually learning skills to deal with science. And definitely, I think we as scientists need to be more engaged with the public through blogs or getting on TV or even just through social media, which myself and our lab do on Twitter.
Yeah, and it is happening. I mean, I see a lot of my young colleagues who are, in fact, engaged in social media. They have blogs, and so things are changing from that. Scientists in particular, and I think academics in general, are beginning to get a little more involved with the general public. That said, you also have to remember, however, that there's a structural problem within the academy. There really is not much of an incentive for people to spend a lot of time talking to the public, simply because that kind of stuff doesn't count for tenure decisions and promotion decisions, or counts very little. You know, the things that really count are how many grants did you get, how much money did you bring in, how many technical publications you had, and to some extent, how well you're doing in your teaching. So until the internal structure, sort of priorities internal to the academy change, you will not see a flood of scientists or academics all of a sudden out there. But I think there is hope because, of course, as I said, since the young generation is engaging more and more to the public, eventually these are the people that are going to be in a position to make tenure and promotion decisions, and so they're going to change the social settings within the academy.
Definitely, especially with the whole point of an academic institution is education and not the business making money. But we do have a caller in, Admiral Casey, is it?
Yeah, our kind of long absentee co-host, so Adam in. Hello, Casey.
I don't see him on the call. I see him in the chat.
I see him in the call.
Oh, well, maybe I just have a crappy internet.
Yep.
I don't know.
Hello, Casey.
Hello.
Hi there, long time to see you. So you're on with Dr. Pigliucci, so ask a question.
Yes. I was wanting to know, well, me being a guy that hates the concept of global warming denialism, was wondering what you thought about people such as, there's this person, his name's Mr. Killian, though of course I'm sure you don't know him, but all I know is he's like the skeptic, like while he does address evolution and also vaccine denial and, well, is a staunch defender of them, he denies global warming because, well, he's a libertarian. So yeah. How do you feel about those kind of skeptics?
Well, that's a great question. So it comes down to the issue of what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, human beings have biases, all of us do, not just...
I heard that.
And so we all tend to sort of discard certain things that don't fit with our priorities and our ideologies. In this case, libertarianism. I mean, it's really not a coincidence that the majority of skeptics of global warming are in fact libertarians, and the reason probably is because they think or they realize at some level that if we do agree at a societal level that there is such a thing as global warming, then that is the kind of problem that isn't going to be solved by simply the free market. In fact, it's being caused by the free market to some extent. And therefore that you need, you know, massive government interventions. And, of course, by ideology, they oppose those kinds of things. Now, that said, you know, we all have biases, you know, including liberals and certainly conservatives and libertarians. How do you deal with that? Well, in my previous book, the Nonsense and Stills book, there is an entire chapter there on expertise, because it really goes down to this. If you are skeptical of some notion, or if you endorse some notion because you think it's a particularly well-founded one, the question is, on what basis are you doing that? Now, in many cases where it comes down to expert opinion, most of us, quite frankly, do not have the know-how of actually making up our minds independently. We have to rely on experts. Now, that is not to say that experts are infallible. Of course they're not. You can easily come up with a long list of situations where the expert said one thing and it turned out to be wrong. But that is the wrong way to look at it. The question is, if you don't know any better, if you're not an expert yourself, if you don't have enough background knowledge, what is your best bet? And there, frankly, it comes down to something like common sense. Let's say that, you have unfortunately a brain tumor, and you're going to say, well, what are you going to do about it? I bet that very likely you're going to go to a brain surgeon. You're not going to go to auto mechanic, let's say, or you're not going to go to the astrologer, or you're not going to go to your politician. Why? Because you are betting that your best chance is to go to somebody who is the best that society has produced in terms of that particular field. The same
like
goes
a brain surgeon.
Yeah, the same goes with global warming. Look, I'm a scientist, but I'm a biologist. I'm not a physical scientist, certainly not an atmospheric physicist. So, I have read some of the technical stuff on climate change. I've read the arguments and the counterarguments and so on and so forth. And I think I've made, I have a reasonable understanding of the basics of the debate. But quite frankly, it ultimately comes down to, look, if there is a consensus in the relevant community of experts, which in this case is atmospheric physicists, of course, not scientists broadly, but atmospheric physicists in particular, then I have to say that until that consensus changes, I think the most reasonable thing to say is, well, they're probably right, and if that's what they're saying, that is, in fact, the most reasonable thing to say. Now, they may sound like an appeal to authority, which is a logical fallacy, right?
They're not appealing to authority. I know that.
So the distinction there, it's important to know, because often when I make that kind of, reasoning, when I present that kind of reasoning, I say, oh, but that's an appeal to authority. No, it's not, because an appeal to authority means that would be something like, if the atmospheric scientists say so, it is necessarily so.
Go on.
But it isn't necessarily so. All I'm saying is, I'm making a probabilistic statement. I'm saying, look, other things being equal, since the rest of us are not experts in that area, our best bet is to go with what that consensus is within that technical area until and if that consensus actually changes.
Yeah, and I would say that it would be reasonable to follow the scientists because they've actually been able to do the tests, and the reason why they would be agreeing is because they have similar results. So it would have to be reasonable to listen to them.
Yes, again, it's reasonable, but there's a difference between reasonable, of course, and being certain about it. I mean, there have been cases in the past where the scientific community did get something wrong for a significant amount of time. But the point is, nobody else got it right. It's not like, oh, well, the scientific community got it wrong, but, the astrologers got it right. No, it's that nobody got it right, and eventually the scientists, it took some time, but they figured it out. So to be a skeptic, whenever I hear somebody saying, oh, I'm a skeptic of climate change, the first thing I want to ask them is, so when was the last time that you look at the simulation models that have been used in climate science? Can you actually build one your own? Can you actually, can you tell me exactly what's going on at a technical level? Because if your answer is no, then you probably should follow Wittgenstein's suggestion of, where you cannot speak, you probably shouldn't.
What would you say to people who are political global warming denial conspiracy type people, in that they say that it doesn't matter what the science shows because the scientists are all in the pay of big business?
Well, that's conspiracy theories.
Right. Yeah. First of all, I'd like to see, it's funny when these people say, follow the money, implying that the scientists somehow are making this huge amount of money and they're having vacation houses in Monte Carlo and that sort of stuff. Well, if you follow the money, it actually goes straight to the oil industry. And it goes straight to the climate change deniers. I mean, that's
exactly
what money is. So even by that logic, you know, it simply doesn't work. But the other thing is, there seems to be this idea that if scientists are paid to do their research, which of course they are, somehow
that's
like saying that you shouldn't be going to any brain surgeon because the brain surgeon makes money out of operating on your brain. Well, that's ridiculous. Of course, it makes money out of operating in your brain because it takes time and energy to learn how to operate on people's brains. So, as a society, we decided that we reward those people with, you know, a cash incentive. That's what we do, right? I mean, you don't say I'm not going to go to my auto mechanic because, you know, he makes money out of fixing cars. Of course, he makes money.
Yeah, I would have to.
What else would you do?
Yeah, exactly. Well, Zulu was letting me ask one more question, so I guess this one was more of a personal question for you. What was it like in Italy religiously? Because, well, since I live here in Texas, where a lot of it is, well, Christian conservative, well, I was wondering what Italy was like since knowing that it has a Catholic majority.
Right.
Well, back when you lived there.
Yeah.
What was it like for you?
Well, first of all, of course, I haven't lived in Italy for, you know, the last 22 years, although my family is still there and I visit regularly. But, yeah, it's an interesting difference between the two countries. In fact, I think in general between Western Europe and the United States. The United States, by the standard of Western countries, is definitely an anomaly in that respect. Most European countries, Australia and New Zealand, have a much lower degree of religiosity than the United States. And there are reasons for that which are very well documented by sociologists and historians of religious thought. I mean, it's quite clear, it's well documented that the United States has always had a very strong component of anti-intellectualism at a societal level, and part of that anti-intellectualism comes from the religious, you know, from a religious fundamentalist perspective. So the main difference in living in a European country or growing up in a European country is that although I literally had the Pope around the corner from my apartment, I mean, it was just, you know, I wasn't that far from the Vatican. My apartment was not that far from the Vatican. So I ran in, I took the bus to go to the university in the morning, and it was always going by the Vatican City. So I had the Pope there. Nominally, Italy is a Catholic country. But in reality, most people simply ignore religion and ignore the Pope in their everyday decisions, and politicians tend to ignore the Pope and religion in their everyday debates. I mean, before coming to the United States, I never heard a politician saying, you know, God tells me that I should do this, or God tells me that I should do that. That would look really ridiculous for an Italian. I would say, like, and presumptuous. So even if you're a person, it's like, really, God talked to you personally? Seriously? Why couldn't he broadcast through the internet what he had to say? You know, it's like, come on.
Or just interview on the news stations.
Yes, that would be nice, right? And ladies and gentlemen, tonight we have God as a special guest.
Oh, that would just be wonderful.
Though if he was, I would have to have him interview with Stephen Colbert.
Yeah, of course, obviously.
All right, Casey, thanks for the call. We'll speak to you later.
Well, it was nice talking to you, Pig Lucy.
Good night.
If I pronounce that right.
Yeah.
Sorry, Casey. Well, hung up on you in the middle.
For anybody who's still confused as to how to pronounce Dr. Pigliucci's name, it is Dr. Massimo Pigliucci. I got that wrong?
The G is almost silent. So
that's what I said.
Goodness. Okay. I am trying to tell everybody how to pronounce your name, and I got it wrong. That's awful.
I used to date an Italian. I know these things.
Yeah. English speakers have a really difficult time with things like a GL or a GN sound, so don't worry about it.
Okay, there's two questions from the chat room, one from Evolution. And he wants your thoughts on Richard David Precht, is it? Is that how you pronounce it?
I don't think I have any thoughts about him. What's the context?
I have no idea. That's what he said. He's a philosopher. I just said, wanted your thoughts on him.
Oh, I'll have to get back to you about this because I don't have any thoughts at the moment.
I have no clue. I have never heard of him.
All right. And from Andrew Kelly, it's quite a simple one. What made you want to become a scientist?
Oh, that's actually a good question. It's not simple at all because I don't know.
It's a simple question.
Yeah, it's you know, I remember, so family lore says that I had announced that I was going to become a scientist when I was 5, and that was after seeing the Apollo 11 land on the moon.
Yeah.
But I don't remember that, so I can't certify for that sort of explanation. I do remember that I was interested in astronomy in particular since I was a small child. I begged my grandparents, I grew up with my grandparents, and I begged them to get me a small telescope, which they did when I was in junior high school. And then in high school, I started building my own telescope. So I had an interest in astronomy from early on. At some point, I think between transition, early on in high school, that interest shifted from astronomy to biology. And by the middle of high school, I definitely knew that I wanted to become a biologist, although I didn't know exactly what kind of biologist. And then finally, during my first year of college, I read that famous article by Richard Lewontin that I mentioned earlier, and I decided that, oh, this is what I want to study, gene-environment interactions. So it was a process that happened over a period of time. I obviously had some kind of interest since I was very, very young. And that interest got shaped by a bunch of different things, including the fact that my grandparents were sensitive to it, and so they started buying me, you know, books and bring me to the planetarium or, you know, whatever, or the Museum of Natural History, that sort of stuff. Then the interesting thing is that I also developed fairly, very early on an interest in philosophy, because in high school in Italy, you have to take 3 years of philosophy. And I did, and my teacher was a great teacher. She was, you know, very energetic and, you know, very engaging. So I developed that interest in philosophy, but it sort of remained quiescent for a long while. I mean, I didn't, you know, pursue it seriously for a number of years. I kept reading occasionally about philosophy, but not much. And then what happened was that the two interests sort of converged, because I realized that over the years, once I had become a professional scientist, that although I did spend time and enjoyed spending time in the field or in the laboratory working with my graduate students and my undergraduate students and things on actual empirical projects, the thing that really got me up in the morning and you know, got me excited was the more conceptual issues in evolutionary biology. And those conceptual issues are very close to the kind of things that philosophers of science do, and that eventually I realized that for the sort of second half of my career, which started 3 or 4 years ago, I really wanted to be doing philosophy full time, and that's why the switch happened.
Okay, well, that's the end of the chat room questions. We've got 10 minutes left, Lundy, so if you've got any more, I know you had a load.
I've got a lot. I'm going to have to just pick one at random here. Well, I'll just go to the last one here, because it kind of sums up at least the end of your book. The last thing that you went over in the book, in a way, is the meaning of life. And yeah. I won't spoil the end for everybody, but I would wonder on what exactly is your position on, say, existentialism. I personally find existentialism to be a very appealing thing to think about. And also, for all the nihilists out there, what would you say to those who say, you know, there is no purpose, so there's no point to do anything, and they're just confused as to why they would even get out of bed in the morning?
Right. Oh, those are two very interesting questions. So, existentialism first. You know, I read Jean-Paul Sartre and some of the other existentialists, and as you put it, yes, they are very appealing. There's something appealing about that way of thinking about existence. The problem, however, with existentialism that I found is that it doesn't take seriously the fact that human beings are not completely free to do whatever the heck they want. You know, the reason existentialism is such an exhilarating and liberating philosophy is because it assumes that essentially you can rework yourself and you can remake yourself into whatever you want. It's up to you. You are in complete control. Well, both sort of other philosophies in general and science in more recently have shown us that that's not really the way it works. Human beings are complex outcomes of gene-environment interactions, where the environment, of course, in the case of human beings, is largely a cultural environment. So there is some degree of plasticity, there is some degree of, you know, possibility of changing things and making decisions in a new direction. But a lot of your interests, a lot of your character, a lot of the way in which you look at the world is actually set fairly early on, and in part is even the result of your, you know, predispositions from a genetic perspective. So I don't think that existentialism is a viable philosophy, because it doesn't take seriously enough the fact that there is such a thing as human nature, and it's not infinitely plastic. You know, you can do things, but not quite as with as much freedom as existentialists seem to think. Now, nihilism I find completely unappealing, and quite frankly, not useful at all. So nihilism is, first of all, you know, this will be a long conversation, but nihilism is rooted in certain metaphysical positions, such as physical reductionism, for instance, the idea that, you know, everything that we do eventually goes back down to the basic laws of physics, and therefore the conversation we're having now, for instance, was set from the beginning, from the Big Bang, because it was not possible for things to go any other way. The physical reductionist will tell you that that is the conclusion that science brings you to, and I think that is profoundly mistaken. Science brings you to no such conclusion at all. Physical reductionism is a metaphysical position that it's actually contrary to at least the kind of data about the universe that we have. The universe is much more complex. There seems to be emergent properties. Stuff happens all over the place. There's a lot of contingency. There is a lot of stuff that happens in random. It doesn't fit the picture, that simple picture of physical reductionism. But moreover, it's simply a metaphysical assumption that goes well beyond anything that science can possibly tell you. It's a matter of, you know, to some extent, it's a temperamental choice. There's some people that feel comfortable with that sort of extreme reductionism that brings about nihilism, and fine, if they're happy that way, that's okay. But it turns out that most philosophers, for instance, these days actually reject extreme physical reductionism. Even philosophers who are naturalists and you know, they don't invoke the supernatural at all. But there's very good philosophic reasons to think that actually physical reduction is a poor description of the way the world actually is, and certainly the science isn't there at all. That said, you know, is it possible that the universe, that there is in fact no meaning, that we are robots that have been sort of doing whatever it is that we were fated to do from the beginning of the universe? Yeah, it's possible. Now, what are you going to do about it? It's not, you know, you still have to get up in the morning and assume that you're actually making decisions. Okay, you want to make the decision still of whether the job you have is a good one for you or you want to change it. You still have to make the decision of whether you stay in the relationship you have or you don't. You still have to make a decision about what to have for dinner tonight, and so on and so forth. It's not like a nihilistic view of the universe actually is going to help you at all with any of that stuff. And very possibly is going to lead you to depression. So I think it's actually a maladaptive situation. So nihilism is definitely far from being true, meaning that we don't know, we don't have any reason to think it's true. It may be true, but even so, it's definitely unhelpful. I think of nihilism, if you will, in a similar way in which I think of radical skepticism. So radical skeptics will point out that we really don't have much of a ground for what we think is knowledge. Okay. They will tell you that we cannot even prove that we exist in a physical universe. We could be somebody else's imagination. Now, strictly speaking, they're right. I cannot prove that all of this is not just a figment of somebody else's mind, or even a figment of my own mind, that I'm not a brain in the vat somewhere imagining that we're having this conversation. Fine. That's a good point in favor of epistemic modesty, right? You know, you don't want to claim too much because it turns out that you cannot actually prove a lot about what you think you know. Great. That said, you acknowledge it, you put it aside, and you ignore it. I still have to live my life as if the universe as I perceive it is in fact real. You guys are real. Tonight I'm going to go to a soccer game in New York, and I'm going to believe that the beer that I'll be drinking there is in fact a real beer and not just an imagined one, because it makes no damn difference if it is imagined or not. I still have to taste it in a certain way, and I will still probably pick a dark beer over a Bud Light or something like that. So I think they're both skeptical. What was that?
I was just complimenting your taste in beer.
Yeah, thank you. So it's the kind of position that it's sort of interesting to think about it for a few minutes and say, yeah, it's possible that things are like that. And then you immediately have to realize, well, so what? I still have to make my choices and my decisions as if it was not.
Wonderful. And I believe we're going to be wrapping up the show now. I'll leave that to Zulu.
Yep, we've got 2 minutes left. So thank you very, very much, Dr. Pigliucci. It's been a fantastic discussion.
It's been my pleasure, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right, and everyone, we are back on tomorrow night with good friend of ours, Graydon Square, so please tune in for that. It's an hour earlier tomorrow at 6 p.m. That's 1 p.m. your time, Lundy, if I remember.
Yeah, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
All right, and thanks to my co-host, as always, Kitch.
Good night, guys, or good evening, depending on your time zone.
All right, sign of silence.
Thank you very much for having me.
Martimer. And Lundy.
That's fine, Marty.
We'll figure out a use for you one day. All right, thanks, everyone. Links are all below. The show will be uploaded within the next few hours. And yes, as Lundy's pointing out, buy the Dr. Pigliucci's book. The link is at the top of the chat room there, Answers for Aristotle. And it's out now. So, again, thank you very much. Links below to get the recording of this show. And we'll see you all tomorrow night for the Graydon Square show. So good night, everyone.
Good night.